First, I have to talk about congruent subgroups. So, G is an algebraic group, and there are various ways of describing them. The simplest way, that G is an algebraic group over Q. The simplest way of describing them is to take this time I'll do it this way. Take a faithful representation on a finite dimensional Q vector space. Then, if I choose a lattice, in other words, a free Z module that generates V, then I can look at, I can define gamma N for N an integer to be the set of G belong to GQ, such that G lambda is equal to lambda, is contained in lambda, so it stabilizes lambda, stabilizes the lattice, and GX trivially on lambda modulo lambda in lambda. Okay. And then we can so this is a special sort of subgroup. And we can define the congruent subgroup to be any subgroup of GQ. So a subgroup of GQ. So gamma contains gamma n as a subgroup of finite index for some n. Now, of course, if you do this with SL2, you just get the usual gamma n's and so on. And, of course, the gamma n depends on which lattice you choose, but the notion of a congruent subgroup doesn't depend on which lambda you choose. And the more elegant way of doing things is to use Ardels, which Jim Arthur has talked about, right? So, I don't know whether he probably talked about the full Ardels. I talk about the finite Ardels. So this is just the restricted product of QL relative to ZLs for L, only the finite primes. So, in other words, it's just the non-Archimedean thing. So, it's contained in here, and it just consists of all the elements in the product such that for almost all L, they lie in ZL. And we can form GAF in the same fashion. It's the restricted product only over the finite primes of GQL. Well, GZL. Well, you have to define GZL, you have to choose something like this over here. But then if I choose two different lattices, some of the GZL will be the things in GQL fixing the lattice when you tensor with. You choose a lattice over Z, and then you look at the things fixing, stabilizing the lattice when you tensor with ZL. And then it turns out that these groups may depend on which lambda you choose, but if you choose two different lambdas, the two different lambdas are going to actually coincide for almost all L, when you tensor with ZL for almost all L. So this thing here is independent of the choice of the lattice. So this group, well, I'm sure Jim discussed this, and then we can define a congruent subgroup. We just take K to be compact open in GAF. Being compact and open means it's not too small and not too big. In fact, it must just be equal to GZL for almost all L. So, and then the congruent subgroup corresponding to this is just K intersect GQ. So what does this condition mean? It means you're looking at the things in GQ, which are integers, at least for almost all L, and satisfy some congruence condition. This would be, if you look at it, this would be an open subgroup of the GZL for all L. So turns out this definition is, so this is a congruent subgroup. And it coincides with this definition. So now we have three types of subgroups. So maybe we should. So we have the congruent subgroups. And so what's the difference between a congruent subgroup and an arithmetic subgroup? Well, a congruent subgroup, an arithmetic subgroup was just, in this terminology I'm using over here. So let's say call gamma 1. The subgroup that stabilizes lambda, this is, maybe we call this GZ. Then an arithmetic subgroup is just a subgroup which is commensurable with GZ. Well, the point is an arithmetic, a subgroup which is commensurable with this, in other words, the intersection of the two is a finite index on both of them, may not contain a gamma n, that's the point. The congruent subgroup is an arithmetic subgroup that contains a gamma n. Okay. So, for example, in SL2Z, you can have a subgroup of finite index, and here, a subgroup of finite index will be an arithmetic subgroup, but you can have a subgroup of finite index which does not contain any gamma n. So you have arithmetic subgroups in here which do not contain a principal congruent subgroup and therefore are not congruent subgroups. And you can look this up on a paper in Mathematische Annalen in 1880. The first example. So there do exist subgroups of finite index in SL2Z, they're arithmetic, but they don't contain gamma n, any gamma n. So we have congruent subgroups. Contained inside the arithmetic subgroups. Well, the set of them. Contained in the subgroups of finite covolume, I was calling them. And if you look at SL2, I just mentioned, goes back to 1880, these are not the same. There are many arithmetic subgroups which don't contain a principal congruent subgroup and therefore not congruent subgroups. And these are not the same either. That's kind of amusing. I mean, if you use the Riemann mapping theorem, what are the simply connected spaces? There's the projective, one-dimensional project. There's the Riemann sphere. There's the complex plane, and there's the disk or the upper half plane. So every compact Riemann surface, if you like, is covered by one of these three. And if the genus is greater than or equal to 2, it's covered by the upper half plane. So every compact Riemann surface of genus G greater than or equal to 2 is the quotient of the upper half plane by a discrete subgroup of the automorphism group. And that will be a subgroup of finite covolume inside SL2, or at least the quotient of SL2 by its center. So they're continuous families of Riemann surfaces of genus greater than or equal to 2. So the fundamental groups are all of this type here. So there are uncountably many over here, and there are only countably many here and here, so there are just many more here. But if you look at the general situation, so general G, what's known, this CSL2 is really exceptional. There's a big theorem of Margulis, which says that if you don't have a group of the form SO1N or SU1N, then these coincide. All subgroups of finite covolume are arithmetic. Here it's more complicated. There are some groups. If you look at SLM for n greater than or equal to 3, and SPN for n greater than or equal to 2, symplectic, then arithmetic groups coincide with congruent subgroups. All arithmetic subgroups are congruent subgroups if you go to these groups. But in general, there are many more. There are many more arithmetic groups than there are congruent subgroups. But for SLN and SPN, the theorem of Bass-Milner and Sear, that all the congruent subgroups are arithmetic, but typically there are many more arithmetic subgroups than there are congruent subgroups. One other thing I should point out is that if you have an isogeny of, what happens if I have a map, surjective map with finite kernel? Then the image of an arithmetic group will be an arithmetic group. So arithmetic groups go to arithmetic groups. But it's important for us to, the congruent subgroups need not go to congruent subgroups. So if you have an arithmetic group here, it maps to an arithmetic group here, but the congruent subgroup here may not be mapped to a congruent subgroup there. We won't actually need any of these facts, but it's sort of useful to have them, otherwise some of the definitions would look a little strange. So now if you have a quotient group and a quotient group, well, for example, if you have SL2 to PGL2, then if you have an arithmetic subgroup of SL2, its image in here will be an arithmetic subgroup of PGL2. But if you have a congruent subgroup here, its image in here need not be a congruent subgroup in here. I should really have examples prepared of this, but I don't. So a congruent, maybe think about it, but there's no reason why a congruent subgroup here should map to a congruent subgroup here. And in fact, they needn't. Okay. So now I want to consider G a semi-simple group. So I hope everyone knows what a semi-simple group is, right? No, by now. One of the courses. So it's something like SL2 or PGL2 or SLN. So here we have D, a Hermitian symmetric domain. And I want an action of the identity component of G on D. So of course I want this to act by holomorphic maps. And I want the conditions that this should be a transitive action. And the stabilizers should be compact. compact. I should say G is a group over Q. Right. So we're starting with a group, semi-simple group over Q, and we're starting the Hermitian symmetric domain, and we want this to act transitively on it. And I want to add one extra condition that is not so important. This is the important condition, but I want that there does not exist a normal subgroup this is over Q, such that a normal connected, non-trivial, I suppose, such that HR is compact. So I just want to exclude the possibility that NR is compact. Right. In fact, if I had a normal connected subgroup of G such that NR was compact, well, the stabilizer of each point, in fact, will be a maximal compact subgroup here. So N will act trivially, NR will act trivially on D, so I could simply divide out by N and I would still have the same situation. So it's not an important restriction. So, of course, the example would be SL2 acting on the upper half plane, or PGL2 acting on the upper half plane. Or I'll give some more examples in a second. And then what I want to do is I want to consider all the quotients, all these things I have to do, where yeah. So G, remember, is G modulo its center. It's G modulo its center in the algebraic geometry sense. So what I mean by that is that if you look at the points in an algebraically closed field, the points of this modulo are the points in the center, but in the non-algebraically closed field, then this quotient here, the points in the non-algebraically closed field, this quotient will map into that, but it may not map onto it. So we have the group G, and we divide out by center as the adjoint group. So I want to look at all the subgroups here, where by, in general, by G add Q plus, I mean G add Q intersect G add R plus. So in other words, the things in the, I'll use this notation all the time. So remember, the plus always means the identity component for some real topology or Euclidean topology. So if I put the plus on the GQ, I mean that I'm looking at the things in here which are in the identity component when you look at them over the real numbers. So I want this to be, gamma to be arithmetic. And I want it to contain the image of a congruent subgroup. In GQ, or GQ, well, GQ plus. So I want to consider, in other words, I want to consider all the, so I have the situation here, and I want to consider the quotients here, where gamma is an arithmetic subgroup in here, and it contains the image of a congruent subgroup in here from the covering. So what we have is a map from G to G add, which is surjective, is a map of algebraic groups. So I'm looking at the arithmetic subgroups in here, which contain the image of a congruent subgroup from here. Now, if I do that, then I have this monster family. I'll try and explain in a second why we take precisely these groups, but and what they look like in particular cases. But now, so we have this family of things, and it's, notice it's projective families. So first of all, the gamma is an algebraic variety by, oh, I should say they're torsion free. It's an algebraic variety. And moreover, they form a projective system. So if gamma contains gamma prime, then I get a map this way. And this map here is a regular map of algebraic varieties. I mean, this is just the projection map. We're taking the quotient by a smaller group, and you get an obvious map from here to here. And I claim that it's holomorphic because, well, it's when I define the, I should have mentioned, when I define the complex structure that made this into a complex manifold, it's actually the quotient of D in the category of complex manifolds. So this will tell you this map is holomorphic, and then Borel's theorem will tell you that it's a regular map. So starting from that situation up there, I get a family of, a great big family of algebraic varieties and regular maps from one variety to the other. And this whole system is called a connected Chamorro variety. So let's write it. This. So just to review, we start with a semi-simple group over Q. The Hermitian symmetric domain where it acts transitively, and just as a stabilizer of every point is a compact subgroup of GR plus. And we put this sort of condition here, which is really no restriction. And then we consider all these quotients, we get this tower of algebraic varieties. Now, there are a number of questions to look at. One is, why did I choose, well, why did one choose, why did Deligne choose this family of gammas? Well, what you want to do, is, of course, is you want the biggest family, so the more subgroups as possible, for which you can prove the theorems you want. See, the point is, we want to, what we're going to do is show that these things are actually not just algebraic varieties, but they're defined over number fields. If I allowed too many groups, then I would get all curves of genus greater than 2, which is certainly not going to be defined over number fields. So I have to put some restriction. So it turns out at least I want them to be arithmetic and not just a finite volume. And it turns out I need to assume they contain a image of a congruent subgroup. I still have some congruence condition on them. They don't have to be congruent subgroups in here, but they have to come from a, contain the image of a congruent subgroup from higher up. Yeah, I guess so. The inverse image of gamma and, as you say, the inverse image of gamma and GQ is such, should be a congruent subgroup, but otherwise contain one of our principal congruent subgroups. The other thing is, what's so special about considering the whole tower? Well, the thing is that if you consider, this will become clearer later, but one thing is clear already, that I claim that you get an action. So the Shimura variety is the whole system. So it's the whole system and the maps between them. So it's this projective system indexed by the gammas. And one thing that's obvious is that Gyad Q plus acts on this whole system. It doesn't act on any individual variety, but it acts on the whole system. You see, if I take something in here, then because it's in the plus, then it, of course, I should have mentioned this action up here. So we get an action. The automorphism group of a Hermitian symmetric domain doesn't have any center, so this factors through the adjoint group. Okay. Actually, maybe I should, it might help also if I mention that when you put a plus here, it doesn't matter what I mean by ought D. If you consider D as a Riemannian manifold, or in other words, forget the complex structure, or you consider it as a complex manifold, forget the Riemannian structure, or consider it as a Hermitian symmetric domain with a Hermitian structure and the complex structure, the automorphism, if you put a plus in here, the automorphisms are all the same. The connected component of the automorphism group is all the same. That's kind of convenient. If you don't put the plus in, then there might be anti-holomorphic automorphisms. But if you put a plus in, then it doesn't matter too much how you think of D when you put this, they're just the complex automorphisms, or they're just the automorphisms as a Riemannian manifold, if you like. So I claim that GQ plus acts because it's in the plus part, is an action of this on D, so we get a map from here to here. And we always have to think about it, but it maps this to this. In other words, it maps, when you multiply by G, act by G, then you map orbits for gamma and orbits of the conjugate of gamma. And the point is that if I take G in here, then the conjugate of a gamma satisfying these conditions is a gamma satisfying those conditions. This is crucial that I take G in the rational points. For example, if you're looking at an arithmetic subgroup stabilizing a lattice, then the conjugate of the arithmetic subgroup will just stabilize G applied to the lattice. So that's still an arithmetic subgroup. And similarly, you can work out that the conjugate of a congruent subgroup is a congruent subgroup again. In fact, the conjugate of, so G add Q acts by a conjugation on GQ itself. And this action preserves congruent subgroups. So if you have anything in here, it gives you an action on this whole family. It doesn't act on any particular variety because, in general, of course, G gamma, G inverse is going to not be equal to gamma. So it doesn't act on one of the varieties in our family, but it acts on the whole family. So you can think of this, you have this inverse system of algebraic varieties and maps of algebraic varieties, and we at least have this group acting on it, on the family. And in fact, we have a lot more acting on the family, but that will do for the moment. Well, I should look at some examples. So, of course, first example is we take SL2 to be the group, and we take D to be equal to H1. Then we're just looking at gamma mod H1, where gamma is arithmetic in PGL 2Q plus, and it and if we take its inverse image in SL2, it contains, so, you know, follow his suggestion. So, phi inverse. And of course, I assume it's torsion free. So, someone's going to point out to me that I'm excluding the modular curve that everybody knows about, namely the upper half plane modulo gamma 1. But, so I'm looking at all the quotients of the upper half plane by things which are arithmetic in here and whose inverse image in SL2 contains a congruence, principal congruence subgroup. I think that's, apart from the fact that I want to assume that they're torsion-free, I think this is pretty much what one normally means by modular curves. We consider the whole family. So what if I take PGL2? So this is just, I mean, the points of this are just in any field look like this. So this is the invertible 2x2 matrices modulo scalars. So this is there's a map from here to here, and the kernel is just plus or minus there. Then, okay. So then I take D equal to H plus H1. And I'm looking at all the quotients where now gamma has to be congruent in PGL2. It turns out this, there are many more up here than there are down here. As I say, I should really have got a whole bunch of examples to convince you of this, but there really are a lot more of these than there are of these. So it's clear that when you're doing this, somehow you should take the G to be sort of, if you start off with a G, you have two Gs. One's with the same adjoint group. And look at the connected Shamur variety defined by G1. Somehow that's better than the one defined by G2, because the condition that it's an inverse image back up here is a congruent subgroup is weaker than the condition here. So But if you take this to be the simply connected covering of the adjoining group, then that's somehow the best connected Shamor variety amongst those ones, because you get more gammas. The more gammas you have, sort of the more interest, the more richer the Shamor, the connected Shamor variety. Well, let's look at a little more interesting example. Of course, we're going to look at a lot of examples as we go, but let's just look at another simple example. So let's take F to be a totally real field. So in other words, F tensor over Q with R is just bunch of copies of R. And I want this B to be a quaternion algebra of R, of F. So it's a quaternion algebra, so it's, it could be, I'm allowing, for the moment, and there's no reason, I'm allowing M to F to be a quaternion algebra, or else it'll be a division algebra with center F and degree 4 over F. So it looks like the usual quaternions, but then if I take B and I tensor it over Q with R, then you see this is canonically isomorphic to just a product of tensoring with R over the embeddings of V into R, F into R. And by definition of what this means to be a quaternion algebra, this would be isomorphic to non-canonical to a bunch of copies of the quaternion algebras over the real numbers, and there are only two of them. There's the usual quaternions, and there's the matrix group. Now, I claim there's an algebraic group over Q such that GQ is equal to the elements of norm equal to 1 in here. So it's the kernel of down to F cross. Yeah. Is that what I want? Yeah. So this is an algebra of finite degree over F, so you can take, there's a norm map here, and if you know what the reduced norm is, you can take the reduced norm if you like, you get the same kernel. So there's an algebraic group whose points are just the elements, whose norm is 1 down here. And if I look at, so this is true universally, so if I want the points in a ring R, then I tensor both these with R. So correspondingly, if you look at the points up here, then over here you're looking at the element matrix, invertible matrices whose norm down to R is 1, so that's just the square of the determinants, or the determinants. So here I get copies of SL2. And here I get something else. I don't know, let's just call it H plus 1. It's the elements of norm 1 and the usual quaternions. So things A plus BI plus CJ plus DK such that A squared plus B squared plus C squared plus D squared is equal to 1. That's what this is. So now there's an obvious choice for D. I can take D to be every time I have a copy, here I take an upper half copy of the half upper half plane. I don't take anything for these. Now, in order to have something non-trivial, I should assume there's at least one of the SL2s, one of the matrix. For at least one prime, one of these factors, matrix factors, does turn up, otherwise there's nothing going on at all. And we let this act on here, just each factor here act on this factor, each factor here. And let's just look at what's going on here. So we have GR as a bunch of copies. So these things are compact. You can check that these things are compact. So you have a bunch of compact factors, then you have a bunch of SL2Rs. And if you map that to GED, and these, in fact, are all connected, so we don't have to put a plus in here. If you put a plus in here, then all I'm doing is each of these has a little center, a plus or minus 1. So this is the same thing, except it's, you're just dividing out each factor by plus or minus 1. And then what's the automorphism group of the upper half plane, this many copies of the upper half plane? Well, you get you get this. So you see, when you pass from here to here, you're just dividing up by the centers, which are always going to be fairly small. When you go from here to here, there really is a big compact kernel. And all the compact factors get mapped to one over here. So given this, we get the Shamor variety, connected Shamor variety. So this is just, so we just look at the arithmetic subgroups of G add Q plus, which contain the image of a congruent subgroup from GQ. And we form all these quotients. So we're defining, so we're taking the quotients of a product of a certain number of copies of the upper half plane by discrete subgroups, and we get algebraic varieties. In this case, the algebraic variety will have dimension, the number of copies of matrix groups you got in up there. Well, I want to get SL2 rather than GL2. I mean, if I took, if I just took the invertible elements in here, I would get GL2. If I just took the invertible elements in here, I want a semi-simple group rather than a reductive group. For the moment. Yeah, if I don't take norm 1, then there'll be a copy of Q cross sitting inside there somewhere. So we get this big family of, well, it consists of all of these things. So in this case, the dimension is the number of copies of matrix groups we got up there. And it turns out that these things will, all these varieties will be compact, actually, if and only if the quaternion algebra you started out with was a division algebra. Is that right? Yeah, division algebra, yeah, right. So only if the algebra we start out with is a division algebra. So the only two, yeah, that's curious. In two cases, either the whole thing is compact, or we start out with the matrix algebra over the total real field. And the second case is called the Hilbert modular varieties. Okay. Okay. Now it's time for double coset spaces. Okay, so this is too easy. I mean, I just wrote this as a single coset space. Hermitian symmetric domain by an arithmetic subgroup. So what I wanted to point out is that in the case that you take G to be simply connected. So in other words, it's the biggest covering of the adjoint group. Then you can write it as a double coset space, which is quite nice. So, well, you must know what a simply connected group is, because otherwise you couldn't know the strong approximation. So. So if G is simply connected over Q, then the strong approximation theorem says that GQ is dense in GAF. This is a strong approximation theorem. Jim Arthur said he stated this. Is this how he stated it, or? Almost. Well, should say that this is if and only. I mean, the strong approximation theorem is only true for simply connected groups. Try anything else, it's not true. Yeah, there are various ways where you put the whole all the dels in here and other conditions. And anyway, this is what the way I wanted to use it. So he stated it, I stated, and probably, yeah, they're a different statement. This will do. So I want to take everything up here the same. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I should point one thing out that I'm trying to follow the way Deline says things exactly, but in some sense, if you're looking at this tower of things, if you're looking at a projective system, you don't care about everything in the projective system. You only care about sort of the cofinal set. So I could, in fact, instead of taking all the D mod gammas, I could have just taken all the D mod gammas by a congruent subgroup of G itself. Then I wouldn't get everything in here, but everything would be covered by something in here. So I could, in fact, in other words, what I'm saying is if you just take the gammas, the congruent subgroups in here, then they form a cofinal system in the projective system, and so it's almost as good. So I'm not going to actually give a double coset description of all these things, but just the ones that a congruent subgroup up in the bigger group. So I take this to be a congruent subgroup. In GQ. And I should also say that if G is simply connected, it is really useful, is that this implies that GR is connected. Okay. Simply connected just means it has no finite covering, which is an algebraic group. And it implies that the real points are connected. So you don't leave out the pluses. That's very nice. Then I claim, if I take a congruent subgroup in GQ, then everything else is the same as over there. And I claim that this is isomorphic to this nice double coset space. So I could write gamma as K intersect GAF. So this is a good definition of a congruent subgroup. It's simply so this is compact open. So I claim that this single quotient here is the same as this. So K is compact open in the finite ideals of the group, yeah, and gamma is K intersect GQ. So assuming gamma is a congruent subgroup, that means I can write it as K intersect in this fashion. Then I claim that this is canonically isomorphic to this. Well, I should tell you how this double coset space works. So it's easier to say, well, this acts on both of them, and this acts on this one. So in other words, if I take a Q in here, and I take a P in here, and a G in here, and a K in here, that's equal to QP, Q, G, K. Well, the first thing is the proof is trivial. We also point out that this is just isomorphism of sets, but I claim it's actually a homeomorphism. So homeomorphism, so left, this is a algebraic variety, it's a complex manifold, so it certainly has a lot of topology in particular. We can make this into a topological space by, this has a topology, and so this is a topological space. In fact, it doesn't matter, you can give this the idyllic topology or you can give it the discrete topology, you get the same topological space on the right. Because here we're dividing out by an open subgroup. So it's discrete. If I give it the idyllic topology, this quotient is discrete. If I give it the discrete topology, the quotient is discrete. So whichever way you look at it, this is whether you give it the discrete or the idyllic topology, you get a topological space on the right-hand side. I claim that's a topological isomorphism, isomorphism of topological spaces. Well, the proof is really trivial. So the map is you send. I often use square brackets to denote, and there you call it P. So square brackets, this is the orbit containing P. So I send that to the double coset containing P1, the obvious map. So I have to prove that's a bijection to start off with. Well, first of all, because because of the strong approximation, GQ is dense in GAF, and K is open in GAF, and therefore GAF is equal to GQ dot K. So this immediately more or less tells us that it's onto, because if I have a P G, I can write that as P, say, Q times K. And then I can get rid of the K. So this is just equal to, I can multiply through by Q inverse. So that's that. So the map is onto everything. And so we just have to check, suppose that P and P prime go to the same element. So if you look up here, what does it mean to say that this is the same as that? Well, it means you can get this from here, from a Q and a K. So if these are equal, that's if and only if P prime is equal to Q times P, and 1 is equal to Q times K, where the Q belongs to GQ and the K belongs to K. But so if you look at the second equation here, it tells us that Q belongs to, well, it belongs to GQ, and this equation here tells it also belongs to K. K is a subgroup, and that's equal to gamma. Okay. So the second equation down here tells us that Q belongs to gamma, and the first equation here now tells us that P and P prime are in the same orbit back here. Well, everybody, just at this point, everybody waves their hands and says it's a homeomorphism, but let me just tell you how to, why. So the way to see it's a homeomorphism is to look at, so it's a bijection. Why is it a homeomorphism? So the way to look at it is, so we have this picture, this obvious maps. And this by definition has the quotient topology. This by definition has the quotient topology. And what's happening here? Well, it's mapping D on, what is this? I mean, this is just there's a group GAF is acting on this thing on the left. So this is just a bunch of copies. This is just a discrete, it's just a bunch of as a topological space even, it's a bunch of copies of D. Each copy of D is open. And now we've got, what we want to do is we want to see that when you go from here to here, this acquires the quotient topology. So you take, you want to see that there's something, is open, an inverse image of something is open, and it's actually open. But the inverse image of something here will just be a bunch of copies of more or less the same thing up here, and each one of them has got to be open.